Science fiction writer Bruce Sterling has become a cyber activist on the issue of climate change and waste in the world. Here's an excerpt from a video interview given in May 2006 and found on Big Picture TV, that's big-picture.tv.
I have theories about effective activism, and my first theory is that science fiction writers are not very effective activists. I think the most effective science fiction writer in politics would be Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House in the United States. A lot of people don't know this guy is quite the sci-fi devotee, but he obviously did untold damage to the body politic. But I also have kind of a principle that if I'm aware of some trend as a futurist and trend spotter, if it actually shows up on my doorstep as an immediate crisis, I will try to do something, pragmatic. And I think science fiction writers are best as fantasists. They're at their best as fantasists. They're neither pessimists or realists. They really are fantasists. But if there is mayhem right on your doorstep, I think it's kind of morally obligatory to take some kind of immediate reaction. So when I first got interested in climate change, I had been complaining for some time that the Indonesian jungles were on fire and the Indonesians didn't seem to be doing anything coherent about their distress. And then Chiapas caught fire and the plume of smoke from southern Mexico stretched all the way up to Chicago and basically covered my hometown of Austin, Texas for about a week. And I was radicalized by this problem. So I then decided I was going to go public with my unease about climate change, because clearly the wolf, if not exactly at the door, had at least left Indonesia and shown up in my hometown. So I thought to myself, well, what can I do? I could obviously involve myself in politics, I could take to the streets or whatever, but I figured it was a very long-term problem that would require some long-term engagement from people going on. So I tried to find something that I thought would not tire me, because the number one problem in political activism is compassion burnout. You're just sort of dragged down and kind of, worn out by what they call sitzfleisch. You're just sitting at one committee too many, and iron pants there makes you despair and you leave. So I thought I would attack the problem as a design problem from an industrial and engineering standpoint, because there's a lot to learn in that, and I thought it would keep me interested, and I'm also a journalist, and I figured there'd be some good material there. So I began really just venting. First I announced that I was starting an internet mailing list, because the internet is the only phenomenon which is of the scope of climate change. It's a global internet and we have a global climate change. And my sort of key insight there was that the one phenomenon could be harnessed to attack the other. Of course, many people think the internet adds to climate change because, you have to plug objects in. But, in point of fact, I think that's it. You really want to just go right into the networks and try to replace voltage with information. And, it's the one kind of area of industrial innovation we have that's expanding fast enough and is doing enough unusual things to really be able to have some technical success at what is really a 200-year-old pollution problem. Dates back to James Watt, and even earlier. So I began, acquainting myself with some of the technical issues, mostly by complaining. Really just kvetching, finger pointing, scolding. There's a lot to be angry about in this. It's not the sort of thing one wants to do in, general publishing, but it's very well suited to an email list. People appreciate the immediacy of it, the kind of passion. The soapbox aspects. Slowly but surely I began attracting a group of people who were not climate experts or climate wonks. They were just, cyber culture types who thought that, this problem was a serious problem and might repay some unusual kinds of engagement. So I still run my list. But I soon got sucked into the world of design, and you know, I was a design professor for a year, and then I wrote a little design book for MIT Press, which is, you know, really a kind of academic précis on the problem and a real manifesto. And you know, I sort of drifted into that world and ingratiated myself with some of the interesting players, and you know, one thing led to another, and now we've suddenly had like a burst of what I like to call haute green, which is, you know, the Vanity Fair green issue, the Vogue green issue, the Elle green issue. There's suddenly a raft of top-end, very designery green retail outfits, tree hugger, you know, their meetings, their designer groups, O2 list, so forth and so on. I mean, that's what I was hoping to provoke. I wasn't the only one doing it, but I was one of the first people to sort of say, you know, yeah, this could be done. We could have designer green, cyber green, or as my colleagues Alex Steffen likes to put it, bright green. And, you know, bright green now has legs. If I'm hit with a cinder block out on Hackney, it will continue as if it had never heard of me. But that particular snowball needed some pushing way up at the timberline. Now it's rolling along pretty briskly. You know, I mean, fighting the greenhouse effect is going to be a universal effort. Everybody's going to have to do it pretty much all the time. I don't think people are ever going to realize how much change is necessary, because people don't realize how much change has already occurred. I don't think that's really the point of doing it. I mean, it's not trying to enlighten the entire masses to do it. I mean, when people adjust, it's basically something like people fleeing the Ninth Ward and running far away, but they don't really have very far to go. I mean, the adjustments don't come because you realize one morning that climate change is happening. The adjustments come because you get an insurance bill for your home in Key West, and it suddenly costs more than the mortgage, because insurers just don't want to go to Florida, because Florida was scourged by 4 hurricanes in a row, and they can't go anywhere. So certain areas become uninsurable, and then you find buildings being abandoned, and, you know, I mean, that's just the way that climate change works. I mean, you read Jared Diamond, and you can see that under, I mean, there have been periods of climatic stress in other societies, and if there's no water, people go, and, you know, if there's less topsoil, the population dwindles. We're not going to be able to design that out. I mean, the ideal tech solution, should there be one, I mean, there are two. First would be emission-free energy. That's a pipe dream, but, you know, you never know. Pipes have been known to blow up, you know, every once in a while. Something weird happens. And the other would be not adaptation, but just sucking the effluent out of the atmosphere. I mean, not, you know, I mean, literally, the carbon dioxide that's there and the methane needs to be sucked out and somehow put back in the ground. It should not have been up there in the first place. And, you know, to go out and tell people, well, put more tarpaulins on your roof, that's not really going to help. We're in a condition of climate change right now. I would predict that it will go through numerous phases. In other words, we don't simply have the nice climate and then the no climate, which is not so nice. We'll have a degraded climate, a seriously degraded climate, a freakishly degraded climate, you know, utter mayhem. And at that point, emissions stop because most of us are dead. So, you know, we actually need to redress, sort of take vigorous steps to do something or other. But, you know, it's not something your aunt at Bethnal Green is going to do. She's not going to go out with a soda straw and suck carbon dioxide out of the sky. This is going to have to be done by people who have some vague idea what they're doing, and they have to have, you know, effective techniques and some backing and some legal coverage and this, that, and the other. You know, where that comes from, I don't know, but the pressure is just going to get worse and worse. And, you know, I'm not an engineer. I'm not going to be doing that myself. What I'm going to be doing is making it thinkable, making it imaginable. I mean, everybody talks about mitigating carbon. Very few people talk about vigorously removing carbon. I can promise you they will be talking about that a whole lot in 10 years, all the time, all the time. And, you know, I'm one of the first people to sort of say it in public. I'm saying it to a very small public. That does not matter. time is on my side. I was talking about climate. I wrote a novel about climate change in the early 90s. You know, you just watch the calendar. You know, I was commissioned to do it, actually, by Peter Lunenfeld of Art Center College of Design. You know, and it's very Californian in its sort of sensibility and packaging. My good friend Lorraine Wild, who's a, you know, LA graphic designer, did it. And, you know, it's very design-centric, and it's kind of pitched to an audience of design students. It was used as coursework in one of the classes I taught at Art Center. And, you know, my title at Art Center was Visionary in Residence. And, you know, why do you want a science fiction writer in a design school? Well, you know, you want somebody who will really think outside the box and just really say things that are just very out there. And, you know, that was my assignment, and this is what I delivered. It's not something I plan to do every damn day, but I think it's actually, you know, visionary work of design criticism. And basically it's talking about, you know, a phenomenon which is happening right now, which has about six or seven different terms attached to it. Internet of Things, ubiquitous computation, everywhere, ambient findability, spimes. And, you know, and spimes is my own coinage. And all these terms examine the phenomenon, the promise of this emergent technology in a different way. I mean, each of these is sort of championing the idea that some part of it is central and other parts are tangential. So my theory, which is, you know, gone into at some 150-page length in this thing, is that the key element is identity for objects. That is, you know, that it's actually putting tags on things, you know, that allow them to interact with, you know, digital networks. And then that is sort of the key concept of which, around which other things accrete. Like, you know, and my goal in this is sustainability. I want us to invent a better way to put our toys away. You know, because we're emitting too much effluent and too much junk, and, you know, it's something we've always done. And we will never be more mindful about it, but I think we could Google the problem. You know, it's like if you want to find something on Google, you get a search engine to sort of winnow out the solution. And I think that's something that the 21st century has brought to the table that was not industrially possible before. So if you think of the problem of sort of winnowing out a tide of garbage, or sorting garbage. Google's very good at sorting garbage. And I think we could do something similar if we tagged our garbage, which basically means tagging everything we make. And we really needed to tag it before it exists. We first need to tag the blueprints, and then tag the manufactured object. And then when it's junk, we need to just be able to read it, know where it goes, ship it, have it ripped apart and recycled. So, you know, my thesis here is that We have a possible new method of dealing with, you know, the entropy in the industrial process, because that's what the greenhouse effect is. I mean, basically, it's a smokestack, it's a tailpipe, and we put the trash into the sky, and now the weather's wrecked. Okay, well, you know, how do we redress that? Well, there are three ways to do it. Either we can abandon industry or replace it with something biomimetic, in which case everything we make rots. Right, and if we'd made just a little bit of CO2, perhaps the plants could have eaten it, and that would have been all right. But, you know, we overwhelmed the system there. The other philosophy is to make things that are permanent, kind of just build things once. Super sturdy objects, get rid of planned obsolescence, and go into a kind of Ruskinian world where every home lasts for 400 years and a fork is something you bequeath to your grandson, and then we can live very parsimoniously, kind of solidly, not consume and not emit very much effluent. And then the third possibility is to just keep track of all the toys. Just fold it all up when it's done. And that's obviously very problematic in a lot of different ways, but it's a new idea. The other two ideas are old, and they have never worked. This idea may have even worse problems, but in point of fact, it's a new concept. So I offered it.